In the scriptures, the Hebrew word Satan actually means adversary. It's applied to any antagonist. Angels and humans, serpents and kings.
So you don't believe he exists?
Am I done talking?
Sorry.
Dorkness to Light, hosted by Emily and Alan Middleton.
We aim to explore what takes place at the corner of theology and geekology.
Episode 1, The Martyr of Hell's Kitchen.
Welcome to Episode 1 of Dorkness to Light, our new podcasting venture.
And blogging and tumbling, and I'm excited to start this project. I don't think I've been quite this excited since we started Shortbox Showcase.
Yes, we do have a bit of a history in podcasting. We've been doing a general interest comic book podcast called Shortbox Showcase for a couple of years. And those of you who are coming to us from that, a recent episode of that show, we announced this initiative. We welcome you. Thank you. We've gotten a lot of encouragement from those listeners to pursue this effort. So again, thank you. We really do appreciate that. If you're coming to us fresh from somewhere else, we welcome you and thank you and look forward to getting to know you. And one thing that this podcast, Dorkness to Light, has in common with our other podcast, Shortbox Showcase, is that the name came first and Emily came up with the name.
I will just reach around, just pat myself on the back for that one. Yeah, name first, concept to follow. Also, a point about the name, it is called Dorkness to Light.
There is no from in that. That especially goes out to those of us who came to us from the comic book podcasting world, where from and to is a common way of naming awesome podcasts.
Of the many things that we have stolen from Michael Bailey, the name of our show is not one of them.
Dorkness to Light.
Also, a shout out for anyone who has tried to find our blog spot or our Tumblr and has gotten a little bit lost.
You probably put a from in front of it.
Hopefully that'll make it a little easier for a few people to find our stuff.
In general, what we're going to be doing with this podcast is to talk about where issues and concepts and ideas related to religion, faith, theology, spirituality, where those intersect with pop culture, often in the form of comic books.
And though this show is not officially a spinoff of Shortbox Showcase, it does have its roots there, because that show is basically just you and I talking about things that interest us, and religion interests us a lot. And we have tried a couple of times to cram those topics into other shows that are only tangentially related.
Even on shows where it's a legitimate side alley to go down, we've always wanted to bring it back pretty quickly to the main topic.
The official topic. Finally, we will have an outlet for all of our side rants about Arminianism and Gnosticism. And apparently people are actually interested in those things.
This specific episode is going to be about the Netflix Daredevil series. Specifically, Episode 9, Speak of the Devil. The series has a ton of religious imagery and specific content in it. And that particular episode is where the bulk of that occurs.
That is the point where all of the stars align. And until I rewatched the episode for this podcasting extravaganza, I didn't realize quite how many of the just great scenes and images and shots.
And conversations.
And conversations. But almost everything that was on our list that we really wanted to talk about in Daredevil
is from this episode.
Was featured in that episode.
Yeah.
Unlike some of the other reviews of the Daredevil Netflix show, this is going to be a lot less plot reliant. It's going to be much more of an open discussion about themes and concepts. We're also going to talk a lot about how freaking pretty this show is.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of that imagery is not exactly subtle, but you have to be looking for it.
Right. And as you said, this we did talk about the Daredevil TV show for about 10 or 15 minutes on episode 33 of Short Box Showcase. And we did spend about half of that time talking about the religious content, because it was such a heavy part of the show. But this is an opportunity to take that conversation and really delve deep and expand upon it.
Now, before we delve, we do want to take a few minutes and talk about the overall plot, the characters, things of that nature, just to give a refresher course for people who haven't watched this show since it came out about 6 months ago. Or for people who might have found this episode and haven't watched the mm-hmm. Daredevil Netflix series. Although, really, you have a Netflix account. Or you know someone whose Netflix account you can steal. Just go watch the show. Like, seriously, go watch it. It's hard to say that Daredevil is my favorite new show. Because the last, like, 18 months have just been rife with really good quality, nerdy entertainment. But Daredevil has got to be in, like, my top three.
And since we're going to be talking in detail about the overall series, begin focusing on episode 9, I think it's obvious, but we're going to go full spoilers. We're going to be analyzing, discussing, so we're not going to be hiding anything or trying to keep things from you. So if you have seen the episode recently and remember these things, that's fine. Also, if you haven't seen it for a while, we thought discussion of the overall plot, where it fits into the overall show,
just
the overall
sort of
series. Yeah, just a refresher reminder of what exactly we're talking about. Now, Emily, you did mention that there's no excuse why people shouldn't have watched this, but some of our geekiest friends have expressed some concerns about how violent it is and have watched just the first episode or two and said, nope, I'm out.
That is a fair concern and criticism that people have leveled against it, that the show is very violent, but more so than that, it's very bloody. And this episode that we're going to be talking about is one of the bloodiest. So we did want to acknowledge, yes, that's it. That is true. It's very violent.
So, big picture overview of the entire series.
For those who don't know, Daredevil is the story of Matthew Murdock, one very Irish, very Catholic, very blind, lawyer by day, ass-kicking ninja vigilante by night. This first season of the Netflix series specifically focuses on essentially his origin story and his journey to actually become Daredevil. So he is not an established hero in this, he's just figuring things out. Along with his partner in litigation, Foggy Nelson, and their awesome secretary, Karen Page, he is investigating the rise of this criminal leader, Wilson Fisk, a.k.a. the Kingpin.
And he's taking over the gangs, consolidating the competing gangs into one ultra-organized, organized crime.
Yes, in order to take over New York.
And this takes place in the shadow of the Avengers movies, where New York has been knocked down quite a bit physically.
Yes.
And a lot of it revolves the corruption in the construction trade in terms of the process of rebuilding
right.
New York City physically.
This version of Daredevil and of New York City and his rogues gallery and his supporting cast is very much inspired by the Frank Miller run on Daredevil, which is really considered sort of the seminal
mm-hmm.
go-to version of the character. I only know this because I have recently, in the wake of my Daredevil fandom, birthed by this show, listened to Dave's Daredevil podcast, though it's not specifically a retelling or an adaptation, it's very much inspired by the Gang War storyline from 1981.
Right.
For comic fans, 1982 is the year of Daredevil.
And it's not Frank Miller who gave Matt Murdock this Catholic background and upbringing. I think of Tony Isabella was the first writer to really specifically identify Murdock as a Catholic. But it was Frank Miller that really utilized that and really took that as not just a character trait, but a defining character trait, and used that aspect also in terms of designing some of the visuals in terms of the stories that he was telling. So he sort of brought the Catholicism front and center, and certainly this show
also
is taking that and making that a predominant character trait. Again, this episode in particular really addresses that. So in addition to this content that we're going to talk about that really appealed to us, you liked a lot of the visuals and just the sort of technical aspects of the show as well.
Oh, yeah. I am a fiend for behind-the-scenes specials and things of that nature. I am really into things like costuming and set dressing and cinematography and lighting. And this show, at least in my opinion, is gorgeous, which really says something considering that it's essentially a low-budget TV show, that it's a Netflix original. I, as far as I'm aware, don't really have a ton of funding, but the show does not look cheap. It looks gorgeous, especially the intro sequence, which I really think is one of the greatest intro sequences I have ever seen. It sets the tone. The intro music is great. And as with a lot of things in the show, it is very bloody.
You, in essence, have the city being rebuilt in blood as parts of the music are playing. That's in essence what a lot of the visuals are.
Exactly. And there's great shots, a statue of blind justice but with her sword arm broken, bridges and skyscrapers and the water tower, things that would be recurring visual themes in the show. Of course, the cathedral and a weeping angel, not that kind. Also want to take this point to just take a little digression, which is that I love that this series has an audio descriptive tract for the visually impaired. I mean, you have a blind main character. If there are blind nerds who are interested in the story, they should be able to experience the story. And the audio descriptive track itself is almost seamlessly dropped in. The show itself is paced very slowly in a lot of places, which, when I heard the audio descriptive track, made me wonder if they specifically paced it slow.
So that there would be time for the descriptions.
To drop in the descriptions. The Foley is excellent, and the two in combination essentially turn the show into a fantastically produced audio drama, which I am also a massive fan of.
So if it's late at night, you want to catch a little Daredevil on your way to bed, you say, fire up the Netflix, put on the audio descriptive track.
Plug in your headphones
and
go.
Let it go. Close your eyes and you can get pretty much the full effect of an episode.
All that talking about how you don't need the visuals to appreciate the show. The visuals are stunning. The lighting and the set dressing and the cinematography are all gorgeous in this show. And it really does a good job of getting the grimy, gritty, dirty, rough city, but also feeling homey. That you really do get a feeling of how Matt feels about his city. Of yes, it's broken and things don't quite work right and there's grime around the edges and the windows are all dirty. But it's his home.
One of the things I wanted to talk about is almost more a critical analysis piece here, a critical theory. In film and in TV, everything you see is there on purpose. Those sets are designed. The shots are framed. These things aren't just accidents. Perhaps on something very low budget, a semi-professional production, you might get something happening in the background that you didn't expect. But for the most part, when you're dealing with a production of this level, everything that you see is intended to be there. Everything on the screen is intended to be there.
Everything had someone in charge of putting it there. There was a set dresser or a lighting specialist or a gaffer who said, put this here, light it like this, shoot it this way.
So again, we want to talk specifically about a lot of the stuff that happens in episode 9 called Speak of the Devil.
Like all the episodes, it's shot really well. But it's also shot and edited and presented in a kind of unique way that the story itself is told out of order. We will not be talking about it in order. We'll be going a little more thematically. But a lot of the scenes are juxtaposed against each other. Right. Things are progressing almost in reverse time as we start in media res and then follow Matt's decisions for the previous 24 hours that have led him to this point.
Right. And this point is a fight.
A massive, awesome fight, which is sadly a little overlooked. For anyone who watched the first couple episodes of Daredevil but wasn't quite able to get into it, or just anyone who had a Facebook account, got on YouTube, was in any way on the internet in April of 2015, the hallway scene, TM. Even if you haven't watched the show, you've seen it. And everyone talks about that as being the pinnacle of fight choreography.
Yeah, the fight scene at the end of episode 2 is the one that everyone talks about. But I think the fight in episode 9 is pretty great, too.
Yes, but in a very, very different way.
Right. For one thing, it is spread out over the entire episode. Like you said, it cuts a minute or two at a time throughout the entire episode. And even, because it starts in the middle, and then by about the middle of the episode, we jump back to the beginning, get up to that point, and then the episode ends with the end of the fight. But interspersed throughout it were these other scenes as well.
It almost goes without saying, but it is, of course, choreographed beautifully.
Right.
And, you know, the Daredevil stunt team is phenomenal.
Pretty good, yeah.
You know, they literally stole Captain America's stunt double.
Right.
It's really good. And again, I am a big fan of behind the scenes. So I have, of course, in the last 6 months, looked up lots of clips talking with the stunt teams and interviews about the process going into creating these. And something that the stunt choreographer said really stood out to me is that he said, every scene should tell a story and every action needs to mean something, needs to progress that story along. And this was, as always, in reference to the hallway scene at the end of episode 2. He said you should be able to follow the flow of a story by how Matt is moving and when people are coming and going and the ebb and flow of a fight. But I think if you want a fight that tells a story, the fight here in Speak of the Devil is really sort of the pinnacle of storytelling through action scene. Now the question is, what story is it telling?
You are a worthy opponent. It is an honor to claim your life.
The show came out the Friday after Easter in the U.S. Our church, for either the second or third year, had done sort of an evangelical version of the Stations of the Cross, and I had, you know, walked through that. And this year, for the first time in 4 or 5 years, during Holy Week, I watched the Mel Gibson Passion of the Christ movie. So suffice it to say, I had Good Friday and those sorts of things on my mind when I sat down to watch this episode and was confronted with this fight scene. And certainly, you know, what we are bringing to a piece of art at a particular time will affect us. So there's a lot of blood and a lot of fighting and a lot of bruises and cuts and contusions to Matt. And I'm thinking, wow, this is so much a passion play, but that's probably just where my mind is. Interesting how similar, and then the more it goes on, and the more it goes on, and when you get to the end, and then when you watch it a second time, there is no doubt that that is actually what they're doing.
It is literally a passion play.
By the end of this, Matt has plenty of injuries. Some very specifically we'll talk about.
I started picking up on this, I think probably about the same point that you did. And again, it's a subconscious thing. You just start thinking, oh, that's odd, or I wonder
this
why.
This is ringing a bell, but it's just something that I've, imagery that I'm familiar with. Maybe that's explicit, maybe that's implicit, it's just hitting something.
Yeah, but this also goes to what we were just saying. Nothing is an accident.
Yep.
They didn't accidentally create this sequence so that Nobu was using a weapon that was essentially a bladed whip. It was not an accident that the first thing he does that we see is he swings the chain at Matt, and Matt lifts his arms, and it slices right across his wrists. That is not an accident. Now, what it might mean, wow, that's a very strange beat that you would put in a fight sequence. I wonder why they did that, or that's an interesting image, or...
I haven't seen that much in a fight, and that might be all it is. If it weren't all these other things as well.
If it didn't keep coming back and building and building and building. I took notes on this very specifically. I broke down the process of this fight scene. And as we said, it begins in media res. And Matt lifts his hands to block a blow and gets sliced right across the upper arm wrist section. Then, when the chain comes at him again, his wrists get caught. And he gets dragged to his knees and pulled forward, that he is bound and being led somewhere. In a following sequence, when we cut back, Matt attempts to turn and run away and gets caught in the side. When he attempts to flee, the moment when we could no longer ignore where this scene was going, he attempts to turn and limp away. And Nobu begins swinging the blade again and cuts him multiple times across the back. Eventually catching Matt around the waist, pulling him onto his back, and dragging him across the concrete floor, leaving a trail of blood in his wake.
Now again, 10 days, 12 days, 14 days ago, watched The Passion of the Christ when I saw this. And those two scenes that you mentioned in particular were so reminiscent. There's a scene in The Passion of the Christ about halfway, two-thirds of the way through the scourging, where the guy doing the whipping is pretty tired himself, and he takes a break, and there's a row of some other weapons that he can pick up, and basically picks up a cat of nine tails and begins the flaying of the back with the cat of nine tails. And that weapon was so similar to what Nobu had. And then there's the scene at the end where when Jesus gets led away, his mother and some of the women come to clean up the blood. And so when I saw him being pulled across and leaving the blood trail, I said, okay, this is what they're doing. And I'm not saying that they are specifically doing the beats of the Mel Gibson Passion of the Christ. I'm saying that both of them are doing the beats of the Stations of the Cross. And in thinking about this, I am now surprised that nowhere during this Daredevil fight scene did a woman come in with a cloth to clean up Matthew's face, leaving an image of it on the cloth. If that had happened, I would not have been surprised in retrospect.
I know my soul is damned if I take his life. But if I stand idle, if I let him consume this city, all the people will suffer and die.
There is a wide gulf between inaction and murder, Matthew.
Now, the way that this fight ends, I also thought was interesting, and we'll get to the reasons behind that as we get to the later sequences, which happened earlier. Again,
yes,
non-linear storytelling at its finest right here. This whole episode is a discussion on taking a life, and what justifies taking a life, and if that mortal sin is worth incurring for the right reason.
Right.
And I think it's interesting that in the end, Matt does not kill Nobu, at least not intentionally.
Right.
That what happens is Matt is able to get his hands back on his sticks, is able to sort of recenter himself a little bit before Nobu goes in for the killing blow. And when the blade comes towards him, he deflects it, and it ricochets off into the ceiling, sparking against a light fixture. They had been fighting in a warehouse. Nobu had gotten kicked into some gasoline. The sparks light him on fire. And that almost sort of karmic moment that accidentally, you know, he is being brought down by his own actions, essentially. You know? It's his weapon that, you know,
ends up the cause of his death.
Yes. On the one hand, this is a way to end the fight without Matt being forced to kill someone. But also, this harkened back to the Frank Miller influences on this show. Specifically, The Man Without Fear Mini. And again, this might be stretching, but I just listened to Dave's Daredevil podcast talking about this, and this is what I had on my mind when we rewatched this episode. That in that miniseries, Matt has this moment where he's face-to-face with one of the Kingpin's heavies and says, I don't want to have to kill you. And the man keeps firing at him as Matt deflects the bullets. And at one point, the bullet catches in his billy club. The billy club shatters. And just through a random happenstance of the angle, the bullet goes back and hits the shooter. Again, just another one of those little Frank Miller-y tidbits that's woven into this show overall. And weirdly, a sort of karmic retribution type of thing of Matt has suffered enough. Yes. We're going to bring this to an end.
Then to get back sort of to the theme or the storytelling of the fight, there's still two little moments. One is at this point, the Kingpin does come into the warehouse or wherever the fight is. Matt is beaten up pretty good, and then the Kingpin himself goes in and a dozen or so swings right at his face. And that's the point where I thought that as bloody as some of the scenes had been before, it's that pullback of seeing Matt's face where I think, you know, for the first time, this was what we in the passion play business call the full caviezel, that his face was totally bloodied and beaten and swelling, etc. And so you really got that portion of the imagery in. And Matt happens to escape
by, very important to me, leaping out a window. Because my one complaint with this show, not enough people thrown through windows.
So he throws himself through a window, and he lands in the water, and describe the scene of him landing in the water if you freeze frame it just perfectly. I say this because nothing is an accident.
The shot is from below the water level as you see the figure of Matt falling towards the water. He crashes into the water. He goes completely limp, his arms out to his side. As he sinks into the river, blood trailing from his left wrist, his right wrist, and his side. And at that point, the subtext was just text.
Yes. Here in 21st century filmmaking, that is all CG. I mean, it's not like he had, well, like there were a couple of practical blood packs that he had somewhere, and this just happened to be.
Yeah.
That scene has to be 100% CG. So they are specifically putting the blood in those places for a reason.
Mm-hmm. And that reason was awesome.
And just in case you think we're reading way too much into this, a couple of episodes later, there's a comment.
Yes, it's from our friend Claire, the night nurse. And she says, the only thing I remember from Sunday school is the saints and the martyrs always end the same way, bloody and alone.
If they're specifically calling back to saints and martyrs, that is what this scene was about.
Yes.
Again, they're commenting on their own work. Sometimes you read into something, this is reading out of it.
Yes. And I want to take a moment here to just have a little sidebar about the difference between subtlety and effectiveness. Mm-hmm. That something does not have to be subtle. This leitmotif is not subtle. the duality between Matt and the Kingpin and their mirror images of each other are not subtle. They each have a male and female cohort that forms a little triad of good and evil. They have the exact same speeches. It's not subtle, but it's good. And I think that this leitmotif about martyrdom with Matt is also far from subtle, especially by the end of episode 11, where we get that capper on this overarching theme. But it's really well executed. Something does not have to be subtle to be good. And being unsubtle is not always a bad thing. I mean, it's comic books.
That's true.
It's supposed to be over the top.
So this episode obviously contains this, running throughout it, this amazing fight scene that has some meaning behind it, some intention behind it. But I'm tempted here to say, but wait, there's more. Because this episode also contains two long conversations with our favorite side character, our favorite minor character of the whole series.
Seal of confession still applies, even over lattes. That what you're worried about?
So, as we mentioned, Matt is Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a couple of great conversations in this episode with his priest, Father Lantum, otherwise known as Father Latte.
Father Latte is officially the best.
And there are two scenes with him, two conversations, taking place on the same day, probably 6 or 8 hours apart, one early in the morning, one late in the day. We're going to probably try to keep them separate because some things have happened in between there. And we're thinking about doing, an ongoing series on the Tumblr, on the blog, a list of, our the best clerics ever in fiction. And Father Lantum makes that list. He makes that cut.
I'm pretty sure he has the number one spot just reserved for him.
A couple of great scenes, great conversations. So to walk us through a little bit of what was going on in that the first conversation.
Well, the first conversation, we have some follow-up from when, in the very first episode, Matt goes to confession for the first time in ostensibly years before the series begins, and he kind of needs to unburden himself before he goes and beats the crap out of some human traffickers. In this episode, we get some follow-up that Father Lantum knows who Matt is, knows he's the son of Jack Murdoch, knows what he did in his childhood, saving a man from an oncoming truck, which resulted in his blindness. Like, he knows him. And Matt has a moment where, as he's mentally gearing up to really take on the Kingpin, now they sort of know who this guy is and what he's doing and what he's been responsible for. And Matt is debating the morality of killing him. And thus has to go and seek some guidance. Gets invited in to take a latte, and he is able to unburden himself of some of the questions that he's wondering about. The nature of good and evil, right and wrong.
And this is the scene that gave us our intro clip, where Matt asks if the father believes in the devil. And the father gives actually a much longer...
Well, because he asks, do you want the short answer or the long answer?
The father then tells a story about being in Rwanda, I believe, and facing real evil. He just tells a gory story of the warlord and the local religious leader there, and that the warlord's minions were, tasked to kill this man, but he was so holy, even they couldn't bring themselves to do it. And
such a righteous man, you can't go against him, and he's just so kind and good. Eventually, the warlord comes to see for himself
who this great holy man is.
They talk for hours before the warlord personally drags him out in the village square and executes him and his whole family.
He says, at that point, I saw real evil for the first time. And I'm reading a bit into this, but what I'm thinking about with Father Lantum, just with some of the history that he's telling, is you get the idea that he saw his life being an academic. That he saw his life as one of teaching theology.
Yes. He's much like us. That he's very much interested in the concepts and the teachings and wanting to read old books and teach ideas and philosophy and ethics as much as sort of nitty-gritty religious guidance.
Yeah, the backstory of the story he tells about what went on in Rwanda was he said that at this time he was thinking more of the devil or evil as a concept. And that this is really what sort of changed his mind about that. And you, again, just get the feeling that he envisioned his ministry / career path to be towards teaching seminarians, teaching theology.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up in a pretty rough neighborhood as a parish priest. And he doesn't say, but my headcanon is it was this type of experience that really brought the reality of his theology.
Right.
And that he wanted to attempt in some way to live it out among the real world instead of the ivory tower.
Exactly. And this is the moment where really the writing just stands mm-hmm. out. Because both Matt and Father Lantom are very well realized characters who are strongly influenced by their religion.
Mm-hmm.
But they are very different people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this specific kind of character who comes from the academic and critical thinking side of religion is really rare to see in fiction. Because a lot of times it's easier to write characters that are stereotypes, especially for clergy. And we actually received an email about this topic from one of our listeners on Shortbox Showcase and didn't really have time to dig into it there. So let's bring it up here.
Yeah, friend of ours, listener to that show, Neil Stanifer, who does, just for interest of full disclosure,
mm-hmm.
describes himself as an outsider to the world of faith, but it's a topic that really interests him. So when he saw the Daredevil series, he wrote in and said, I bet you have some things to say about Father Lantom, don't you?
Oh, yes. Many things.
And that, you know, we went back and forth a little bit, but he was talking about that what he liked about the characterization of Father Lantom was how non-stereotypical he is. And he was thinking of the stereotypes of, on one hand, the prude or the
holier than thou, puritanical, yeah. judgmental.
Exactly. That stereotype of a priest on one hand, and he was sort of thinking sort of the opposite of that might be Father Mulcahy from MASH or the Reverend from The Simpsons. You know, basically the self-help section.
Yeah.
The sort of empty
platitudes.
Yeah, platitudes, the empty God talk. And what he liked about Father Lantom was that he was neither of those things, which we so commonly see in pop culture. One of the things that that Neil wrote was that those stereotypes are limiting, and they seem to come from ignorance, in his experience, especially with high church priests. These are guys, and occasionally gals, depending on the denomination, who've been through seminary and have been exposed not only to scripture, but church history, comparative religious studies, form criticism, redaction, and so on. They tend to be very clued in an intellectual sense. And that's a lot of that is what you get from two scenes with Father Lantom in this episode, which might total 15 minutes. And back to Neil, he says, anyway, the Daredevil portrayal of Lantom is refreshing. I've had some of my most engrossing religious discussions with Catholic and Episcopalian clergy who took seminary seriously and kept their intellectual curiosity even after taking holy orders.
Yeah. The amount of complexity in the theology that this show brings and specifically puts in the mouth of Father Lantom is wonderful.
Right,
me.
And the depth, and again, the reality, the steering clear of either extreme of those stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. To get a little personal, this was one of the first times that I really heard religious topics that I personally wrestle with a lot
mm-hmm.
discussed in television in a way that A, didn't treat its listeners like idiots,
mm-hmm.
and B, came to conclusions that were rather similar to my own.
I would say this might be somewhat what you're saying, but actually treated the question seriously.
Yes.
Didn't just dismiss the question as, if you have enough faith, you'll understand it, or you don't have to worry your pretty little head about that, God's got it under control, or whatever the simple, really dismissive answer might be that maybe if you're in first grade and you ask that at Sunday school, then maybe you can be dismissed.
Yeah.
But when you're a growing, grown adult,
that's
you'd actually rather wrestle with that question and get a serious answer.
Yeah. Matt is an adult. And this series, for good or ill, is an adult series.
Right.
And not just in the let's have lots of blood way, though it does have that, but in the let's treat our viewers like adults who have these sorts of complex questions, who reason with faith, regardless of whether or not they have it, in a mature and intellectual sense.
Right.
And that was wonderful. Matt himself brought up these sorts of topics a little bit in an earlier episode, which is one of my other favorite episodes, episode 3, where you get to see Matt in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a great speech that says, I have been preoccupied of late with questions of good and evil, right and wrong. And this just goes back to the show not being subtle, but being really good with the parallels that it brings mm-hmm. with vigilantism and Catholicism. That in a sort of hilarious quote that Frank Miller had on the character, he said, in my mind, Daredevil always had to be a Catholic, because only a Catholic could rationalize being both an attorney and a vigilante. That there is something mm-hmm. there in this question of duality, and this idea that you can be a good man and bad things will happen to you.
Right.
Or a bad man, but you don't deserve certain things, mm-hmm. like murder. But that these questions are to be wrestled with. That you should be thinking about these questions. These are complex questions. That is where your faith should be rooted, is in trying to figure them out.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the way that the show and Father Lantum really walk a line that I think a lot of actual religious people, specifically Christians, Catholics, walk, of having faith in the supernatural and an understanding of the real world simultaneously.
Right.
That Father Lantum says in the clip we played at the opening that originally Satan was just the adversary, whatever that was, and that over time that mm-hmm. was conceptualized as a single potent supernatural evil. But he also says, I do believe that absolute evil exists. Not sure how.
Maybe not.
Is it Mephisto? Maybe not.
He uses the word propaganda in that discussion. He says, maybe not in the way that the medieval church propaganda would have you think of the devil or of evil, but it's relevant and it matters.
And it is to some level, to some degree, real. And potent, mm-hmm. and needs to be addressed in your theology, in your ethics, in your daily life, that evil is real.
And how,
it will find you.
And the how to deal with it is not an easy answer.
Yes. So basically, Father Lantum, fantastic questions, fantastic answers that don't really make you feel better.
They do make you think better, maybe.
And that is the point.
You're religious, Karen.
My parents were. That's probably why I'm not. You?
Catholic.
Does it help with things like this?
Not today.
There is a later scene with Father Lantum that we want to talk about as well. But also there were a couple other scenes within this episode that sort of touched on some of these ideas as well.
A lot of these smaller scenes were just scenes that I forgot. Oh, yeah.
That's in
this too.
That's right. That's in this episode also, yeah.
In addition to all of this awesome religious imagery and religious content and discussions about the nature of good and evil, this is also the episode that gives us, I believe, the only scene in the entire show where Karen, Foggy, Matt, and Ben Urich, their newspaper contact, all share a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a little bit of discussion there about who is the man in the mask? Is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Is what he's doing justified? Is he a terrorist? Is he a hero? Matt, of course, smirks every time Karen compliments Daredevil because he is literally the worst at hiding his secret identity. But it gives us some good lines. Like, when they're talking about what the man in the mask's next move is going to be and if he is going to take that next step and try to kill Wilson Fisk. And when they wonder why the man in the mask hasn't been as active, Ben says, maybe he knows there are some roads that you don't come back from. We also get a hilarious little bit with Matt trying to direct his partners in not getting themselves murdered by bad guys, since they are not blind ninja vigilantes who can take care of themselves. Most importantly, you must know your enemy. Thank you, Sun Tzu. Even this episode, which is very serious, has little moments of humor in it, which is an overall thing in the series that it's surprisingly funny at times and is a thing about the Miller run. It's remembered as being really dark and grim, but the whole people getting thrown out of windows running gag and people throwing themselves out of windows, that was Miller. And it's legitimately funny. For all that this is a very serious show with very serious issues that treats its questions seriously, there's light moments. Just enough to keep it from getting really depressing.
A couple of important character things happen. One very specifically happens between his first conversation with the father and his second conversation with the father. And that's going to the art museum to meet the Kingpin's main squeeze girlfriend to try to get some intelligence on him, if you will, to sort of...
And a little, maybe a little bit of flirting with his arch nemesis's main woman.
Well, that happens too. That's just because he's Matt Murdock and that happens. But a blind man attempting to buy art was an interesting scene that could have been silly, but wasn't.
Yeah.
Actually, it was a serious discussion of art and of beauty and of color and etc.
And it also gave us some funny lines. It isn't about how art looks. It's about how it makes you feel. You don't have to see to feel. Sight helps. Okay, thanks, Matt. Going on my earlier point about subtlety being good, but not necessary, we get a great moment where Vanessa picks out some art for Matt and says, imagine a sea of tonal reds, the color of blood, but also of the heart and of compassion. And I was like, okay. And this episode is not just the first meeting of Matt Murdock, not the man in the mask, with Ben Urich, but also the first meeting of Matt Murdock and Wilson Fisk. And we get a moment where the two of them get to lay out their respective life philosophies.
Their theses for their actions.
Yes.
That both of them love the city, but they're clearly expressing it and going about it and attempting to save it and preserve it and make it better in quite different ways.
Yes. And at the very end, Matt, of course, is not even very low-key, just straight up panicking as he attempts to get out. And Vanessa asks him, did you change your mind about what you came for? And he said, I simply need to consider the cost. Good day. This was, again, one of the examples of the double meanings that they work into the writing. And we'll get to another one of those later. But it's not subtle writing.
Right.
But it's good writing. Mm-hmm. And until you write the lines down, sometimes you don't even realize the second or third meanings that some of these lines have.
Right.
Also, for a little bit of context, just in the overall plot and subplots that are proceeding, this is the episode where we see the Nelson and Murdoch sign. Yay! Awesome! Things are progressing. And 3 minutes later, Elena Cardenas is dead.
One of their early clients.
And adopted grandmother of the firm. And it is revealed that she was killed by Wilson Fisk as bait.
Mm-hmm. And then in their grief, Karen and Foggy and Matt go, of course, to Josie's bar, where Matt doesn't drink very much, but of course, Karen and Foggy do, because that is what they do.
It's a wake. You're supposed to be drunk and miserable.
And there's an interesting conversation that Karen and Matt have about being religious, and Matt saying he's Catholic, but that at moments like this, that doesn't necessarily help.
Right.
And what I liked about that is that there is sometimes this notion that faith is what you do to make yourself feel better. That it is the best self-help idea out there. And I'm quite annoyed by the evangelical wing of the church that has somehow turned faith and Jesus into the best self-help plan.
A Band-Aid for your life.
And you work at the library. You go through the self-help section, and you file things in the religion section, and they're often the exact same book with a little gloss of religion added or a little gloss of religion taken away. And I like what Matt is saying here, is that it's not just about feeling better. It's not just about it working. It's about other things as well. And mm-hmm. I like that very sort of subtle aspect to that. We do get the idea from early in the series that he might not be as practicing a Catholic as he had been in the past. And certainly he does seem to be actually moving in that direction throughout the series. And maybe that's one of the things he's wrestling with is should my faith be helping me more at a moment like this? What are the roles
mm-hmm.
of that?
Yeah, it does say something that his therapy, quote unquote, vacillates between being beating up criminals really brutally and going and talking about his religion with mm-hmm. Father Lantham, that those are the only things that can really help him cope.
Right.
Certainly in situations this terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And we get one more great quote from the end of this scene where Karen says, if there is a God, Fisk will get what he deserves. You have to believe that. And we get another one of those great double meanings where Matt replies, I do.
Meaning, I will either bring it to him and or God will bring it to him, or maybe I'm doing that service to...
This is one of those moments where Matt might be thinking to himself, I am the right hand of God's vengeance, and he abomination.
And so we're not sure exactly, you know, where Matt is in his practice of his faith, but there is just an interesting, quiet moment where, we said, this fight scene with Nobu is spread throughout the entire episode.
Quite in order.
And then also not told chronologically. We actually see, towards the end of the episode, him suiting up for the fight, which we have seen has been going on throughout the episode.
And we see where he keeps his suit,
mm-hmm.
which is in the bottom of his dad's old boxing trunk.
Right.
It has all of his dad's robe and various and gloves and his paraphernalia on top of it. But it's also right next to his crucifix in his apartment.
Yes.
He has his crucifix hung on the door of the closet where he keeps not just his dad's memorabilia, but his superhero vigilante costume.
So he is suiting up for work in front of the crucifix, and so, of course, crosses himself.
Right before he kneels and gets his... It's just, there's a great moment there, because he's pacing as he's still struggling with himself about if he should go to this fight and when he gets to this fight, whether he will be quote-unquote prepared to do what is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And he's struggling with this and he's pacing and he's clearly agitated.
Right.
But there's a moment where he sort of centers himself, crosses himself, kneels, gets the suit. And I just,
he's ready for action.
That little process, like that little ritual of pacing. I don't know what to do. Cross myself. Okay, I'm committed.
Right.
Now I'm going to do this. It just speaks to his mental state, his religious feelings. Not to harp on the Frank Miller thing, but that is really where the whole like ninja aspect of Daredevil was really explored. And I've personally thought this, and I like that it's shown in this show, that Buddhism and like Taoism and some of the Eastern philosophies are actually quite compatible with Catholicism.
Right.
And
in terms of meditation and mindfulness and some of those areas.
Yeah, and focus and discipline.
Right, sure, right.
And so I like that those are both, seem to be pretty synchronized and synthesized into Matt's worldview.
Right.
That religiously, he is a Catholic, and by this point in the series, a pretty solidly practicing Catholic. But that he does have, from his childhood, from his training with Stick, he has this appreciation for the importance of meditation and breath control and mindfulness. And I said it earlier, karma. And the line between maybe the will of God and karma and how much of this is going to happen without him and how much of this he has to go and make sure it happens.
Karma is not exactly the same as reaping and sowing, but they're philosophically in the same ballpark.
Yes. The show very much focuses on his Catholicism, but it actually doesn't ignore the sort of pseudo-mysticism and philosophy that he would have as part of his martial arts training.
I like to have a moment, end of the day, just me and him.
Maybe you could put in a word.
And then the last scene we wanted to talk about was that second conversation with Father Lantham. And again, this is where you talked about how pretty the show is and how well it's shot. And this has a couple of my absolute favorite sequences. And one of them is how this scene starts, where we have an over-the-shoulder shot of the crucifix, sort of three-quarters sort of from behind, where you can see, you know, Jesus on the cross, and then we're sort of flying past that down into the church where Father Lantham is sitting by himself. You know, there are lots of choices that
had to go into that sequence.
Yes. And I'm not sure exactly who to give credit for a specific shot like that. You know, Drew Goddard was one of the creators of the show, but I think he was long gone by the time we got to episode 9. Stephen DeKnight was the showrunner, I think, at this point. Comic book writer Christos Gage and Ruth Fletcher Gage specifically scripted this episode. So maybe a shot
how much
like
do they,
that.
They think about the imagery.
If you're a comic book writer, you may have put in some imagery like that. In a traditional TV script, I don't know that that much stage direction would be part of a script, but again, it might be in a comic book property. The director was Nelson McCormick, not Nelson and Murdoch, which it's very close to, which I'm sure is how he got the gig. But again, TV directors don't have a lot of
creative control.
A lot of impact. It really is a writer's game. The director of photography,
or the
Matthew Lloyd, the DP, I don't know who to give the credit for that specific shot, but A, it sets the scene for the rest of the conversation. There are lots of ways, even to establish a religious person. We could have just started with Father Lantham and pulled out to see that he is among his pews. He could have been lighting a candle. He could have been looking at a picture to St. Peter or to the Virgin Mary, but they're specifically starting with Jesus.
And Father Lantham himself underlines this,
yes,
how important it is for that scene to start that way, because he says that at the end of the day, I always like to end it here with him. That is sort of Father Lantham's own meditation. This is his centering act, that regardless of how bad the day was, or how many things happened, or what didn't you know, go well or what people confessed, and just regardless of how terrible a day he may have had, because it was probably a pretty bad day. He's a parish at a very small, rundown church in a bad neighborhood.
So it's probably not happy things that he's hearing and ministering to all day long. I'm just guessing.
It's probably a pretty rough life, but that at the end of the day, he can find his peace there in the presence of Christ.
It would be much more common or typical to say something a little more generic than that. To even maybe invoke God.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, invoking specifically him, referring to Christ.
Capital H.
Yes, referring to Christ. I just thought that was a really interesting personal choice. Again, there's some level of sort of generic God talk that is somewhat common in both pop culture and regular culture.
Yeah.
But specifically identifying, he's a Catholic priest, so the fact that Christ is the center of his faith is not a surprise.
The personhood of Christ is kind of important.
But the fact that there's, even still, the fact that specifically pointing that out, I thought, was really interesting and just as a choice for the show, but also an interesting choice for him as a character.
Right.
Again, really finishing up that arc that Father Lantom has. It's great that in two scenes, again, maybe 15 minutes total, we learn a lot about him. And again, I'm reading into him, but again, it really puts the capper on this trip that his life has taken, this journey from the ivory tower to the real world, and that the necessity for this type of relationship with Christ is really critical to his ministry.
Which really does parallel what Matt's going through, is his rejection and sequestering of himself, that I'm going to go to law school. I'm going to do this very clinically, very removed from all of these sorts of things. I will fight justice out in the courtroom where things are clear cut and simple. But this whole story is his recognition of, I take over where law meets reality.
Right.
Where there are gaps, where there is injustice festering in places that no one else can do.
Right. They make a point early in the series that Foggy and Matt had an offer to work at one of the big wig, super expensive law firms, and chose to open up a small practice in Hell's Kitchen where they can do real good work.
Right.
And again, they could have, Matt's career path was taking him to not the ivory tower, but to white collar, upscale living.
Maybe not the ivory tower, but the glass and steel
exactly.
tower. A literal tower.
And Father Lantom has made the choice to live among the people of Hell's Kitchen, and so has Matt.
Mm-hmm. We don't get the line in this actual episode, but I do want to bring up the way that Lantom figures out that this nice young Matthew fellow is actually the devil of Hell's Kitchen. That in the aftermath of this brutal fight, he goes back to the church. Father Lantom asks him if, you know, he was able to do that thing that they were mentioning earlier. And Matt says, "You know who I am. You know what I do." And Lantom says, "Yes, Matthew, I'm not an idiot."
One of the things I like about the conversation they have in this scene is that they demonstrate that Father Lantom is not an idiot. Matthew is very well educated, top-notch law school graduate. He's a smart fella, and Father Lantom is hanging with him intellectually, maybe surpassing him intellectually in some of the conversation that they have. And again, I think that is realistic for a Catholic priest. That's not always realistic for ministers from other denominations, but certainly they got that right.
For him to be in this position. He will be well-educated.
Yeah, as Neil pointed out, he will be well-educated.
And he is also the most supportive, even with all of Matt's ridiculous, self-destructive Matt-ness. The way he greets Matt when Matt shows up at the church is just to say, "I thought you might have gone and done something foolish." doesn't even explicitly call him out or sit him down to have a moment, but just says, oh, glad you're back. Is there anything else you would like to talk about before you possibly go and commit a mortal sin and a felony?
Is what Father Lantham is doing here, he's not taking his confession. He's also really not doing counseling. He's doing what's closer to spiritual direction, in that he is asking Matthew some really good questions and having him work out the implications, as well as answering some questions and giving some advice, but mostly it's he's asking questions, he's telling stories, and he's leaving it to Matthew to decide how exactly he's going to work that into his life.
This goes back to Father Lantham just being a fantastic priest and moral counselor and mentor and father figure for Matt, that he speaks most things in parables and in Proverbs, giving us one of our favorite of his quotes.
Like a muddied spring or a polluted fountain is the righteous man who gives way before the wicked. Proverbs 25 something, I never can remember.
It's Proverbs 25:26, by the way.
Oh, well, there you go.
I love the fact that it's Proverbs 25 or something. I don't remember. Yeah. And then they actually have quite an interesting discussion breaking down potential interpretations of what that means.
And I appreciated both of them because both of their interpretations are valid, but do reflect their various ideologies. That Matt sees it that essentially, with great power comes great responsibility. I have a responsibility to stop this however necessary.
Because I can, I must.
Exactly. And whereas Father Lantham's is actually, as with his refreshingly nuanced view of the devil and absolute evil, it's a much more complex concept where he says the alternate interpretation is that giving in to temptation, especially in such a violent and self-destructive, evil manner, will poison not only the person who takes that act, but their neighbors and friends and loved ones, and this sort of evil will spread.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciated both how honest and good and really realistic that sort of advice is, but also how specific it is that this is the point where we, the audience, know that Lantham knows.
Right.
This is tonight, Matt is going to kill someone if he doesn't get a really good reason why he shouldn't.
And given the structure of the episode, the tension is not, is he going to go to this fight?
We know.
This is, I don't know, minute 45 of the episode. I mean, the fight has been going on most of the episode. This is the backstory to what we've been seeing. So we know the decision that's been made, but that does not make this scene any less compelling.
No.
Again, for the way it's written, the way it's shot, the way it is performed as well. There's another shot in this scene of the two of them speaking and the frame... They're in their pews, and the shot is framed with the crucifix on the wall between them. And again, there are a million ways to shoot that scene. You could even shoot it religiously with a generic stained glass window, with candles, with incense. You could have done that a lot of ways, but very specifically showing that, again, is a particular choice that they're making.
And for a little bit of context, just into where this fit in the episode in its entirety, this is before the wake and the sequence we talked about with Matt suiting up. But it comes right after the scene where he goes to the art gallery.
Right.
And it really follows up on a lot of the tension from that scene about why Matt was there. And Lantham asks, where were you? You know, what did you go do? If you didn't go and do something stupid, what did you do? And he says, I found a woman who was close to the devil. And I went to speak with her. Lantham asks, why? And he said, to gain insight about him. And what did you learn? That he is a man and has a woman who would miss him if he were gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of moment gives so much humanity, not just to the Kingpin and to Vanessa, but to Matt.
Right.
Of him getting thrown into this additional moral crisis by recognizing, oh, this person that I think that I need to kill is actually a human being.
Mm-hmm.
Really sort of contemplating the real weight of taking a life. And this show really does a good job of examining that, because it's a superhero show. For a lot of us, the rule is superheroes don't kill. We just know that. But this really goes into an examination of why.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that so anathema to superheroes in general?
And very rarely is the answer, because it will put a stain on your mortal soul. There's usually a different type of answer about being a good example, or sometimes...
following the law.
Or we just don't do that.
But this really does give a grounded, personal reason for why Daredevil does not kill.
Mm-hmm.
Something which I am very excited to see followed up in season two, once we've got Elektra and the Punisher. And because this show just continues to build upon every single line that it, and concept that is laid down, when Matt is trying to express this internal struggle to Father Lantim, he sums it up by asking, so the question for you now is, are you struggling with the fact that you have to kill this man, but don't want to?
Mm.
Or the fact that you don't have to kill him, but want to? And that is just such a perfect capper on Matt's emotional turmoil at this point, and all of the questions he's asking of himself, and am I a good man? Am I a bad man? Is what I'm doing justified or unjustified? It's just a really mm-hmm. great examination of two really great characters who are also really great Catholics.
And you know, one of the criticisms of the show, in addition to the sort of the violence, and as we said, it's not that it's violent, that it's bloody, and that the blood has some meanings to it beyond violence, but also a criticism is that it moves a little slow, especially for a comic book show. And I think, unfortunately, it's probably conversations like this, or maybe even the conversation at the bar, or the conversations with Ben Urich, where people think or people are interpreting that the show is slowing down. And to me, it's A, delivering terrific content, terrific framing.
Yeah. I mean, terrific dialogue, expertly presented.
And it's also building tension, and it's asking questions, and it's doing things that a long-form television, you know, presentation can do, that a movie and even that, you know, the comic book can't get into this level of conversation and this level of depth of these characters. Again, I just love that Father Lantim is not just there to be the sounding board or even to be the sage, the Yoda spouting off some religious philosophy that the character is going to use. Again, he has an arc within this. We learn so much about his backstory. And to me, that's a testament to how good the writing is. And part of the way that that happens is by the somewhat slower pace.
Yeah. I think the pace is beautiful. In my opinion, there are no things in this show that you can change to make it better. There are some things that you could change that would maybe make it a little more palatable
mm-hmm.
or more watchable. But I think that this show is really the pinnacle. Like, it achieves everything that it intends to achieve.
Right. I think so.
Which is, it sets a high bar and it meets it. In my opinion, I think that this might be the single best episode of the show.
Mm-hmm.
As we said earlier, there were so many points where we would cut away from the religious discussion or the fight and be reminded, oh right, that happened this episode.
There's other plot happening. There's other character bits happening as well that are really important and pushing the plot forward.
Yeah, and bolstering the entire mm-hmm. show. That this episode is sort of the linchpin of the entire series.
This sort of end of Act Two, we're really moving into the final stages.
It is. This is the point where we reach.
Well, it is
Matt's lowest point,
yes,
and the highest point,
mm-hmm,
of the show, where all of the plots are coming together. We've turned a corner, and it's getting serious.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, this show is allowed to take its time, like we,
right,
were saying, and really move towards the conclusion by taking time to talk about the themes and the character developments, establish the leitmotifs. Like, this is the core,
right,
of what this show is and is about.
Well, seeing as we've talked about the episode longer than the actual episode was.
Right, yes.
And I think we've pretty much exhausted everything we've had to say. I am sure we have exhausted our poor listeners. We make no promises about when the next episode of the podcast will come out or even what it will be. We have some ideas. We don't exactly want to say where we're going and what we're doing and when we're doing it. But this is the type of thing that the podcast will be.
Mm-hmm. A chance to really delve into topics and pieces of media like this that are just rife for examination.
Maybe not as long as this podcast episode will be, but you never know. We don't make any, no promises at all.
Maybe longer if, you know, I get to take over the show one day. And
no promises, any direction at all.
A final thank you to all of our fellow podcasters who were supportive and interested and pressured us into making this actually a reality.
And then who played our promo, who've helped drive some traffic to this first episode. We really appreciate all that support and all that help.
Yes. Also, it has been mentioned several times, but I would like to specifically recommend Dave's Daredevil podcast. It is a fantastic show. If you're interested in some of the earlier adventures of Daredevil, also he did an entire series on the Frank Miller run. He has a fantastic show.
And his show is available as part of the Two True Freaks Network. So again, thanks for listening. Thanks for your support. And we will have another one of these podcast episodes out sometime.
And until then, may the Force be with you.
And also with you. While you're waiting for the next podcast episode, check out our websites. DarknessToLight.blogspot.com contains reviews, essays, and other similar ramblings.
And DarknessToLight.tumblr.com, which contains some of that material, as well as top tens, cool photographs, memes, and religious puns. We also run a general interest comic book podcast network, Relatively Geeky. That content can be found at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or by searching iTunes for Relatively Geeky.
Let us know what you think of this topic, this episode, or this podcast in general. Feel free to send your thoughts to us at darknesstolight@gmail.com. We would also appreciate any ratings or reviews left for the podcast in the iTunes store to help like-minded people find us.
Our intro, outro, and promo music is by Anderson Kale. Check them out at andersonkale.com or search iTunes to purchase their music.
Thanks for listening.